I think him capable of everything. Well, with the 5 minutes grace, we have only 10 left. I will profit by them to tell you something about my guest.
I beg pardon, interrupted Beauchamp. Are there any materials for an article in what you are going to tell us?
Yes, and for a most curious one.
Go on, then, for I see I shall not get to the chamber this morning, and I must make up for it.
I was at Rome the last carnival.
We know that, said Beauchamp.
Yes, but what you do not know is that I was carried off by bandits.
There are no bandits, cried Debray.
Yes, there are, and most hideous, or rather most admirable ones, for I found them ugly enough to frighten me. I was informed I was a prisoner until I paid the sum of 4,000 Roman crowns, about 24,000 francs, £960. Unfortunately, I had not above 1,500. I was at the end of my journey and of my credit. I wrote to Franz, and were he here, he would confirm every word. I wrote then to Franz that if he did not come with the 4,000 crowns before 6, at 10 minutes past, I should have gone to join the blessed saints and glorious martyrs in whose company I had the honor of being, and Signor Luigi Vampa, such was the name of the chief of these bandits, would have scrupulously kept his word.
But Franz did come with the 4,000 crowns, said Chateau Renaud. A man whose name is Franz d'Epernay or Albert de Morcerf has not much difficulty in procuring them.
No, he arrived accompanied simply by the guest I am going to present to you.
Ah, this gentleman is a Hercules killing Cacus, a Perseus freeing Andromeda.
No, he is a man about my own size.
Armed to the teeth?
He had not even a knitting needle.
But he paid your ransom. He said 2 words to the chief, and I was free.
And they apologized to him for having carried you off, said Beauchamp.
Just so.
Why, he is a second Ariosto.
No, his name is the Count of Monte Cristo.
There is not a Count of Monte Cristo, said Debray.
I do not think so, added Chateau Renaud, with the air of a man who knows the whole of the European nobility perfectly.
Does anyone know anything of a Count of Monte Cristo?
He comes possibly from the Holy Land, and one of his ancestors possessed Calvary, as the Mortemars did the Dead Sea.
I think I can assist your researches, said Maximilian. Monte Cristo is a little island I have often heard spoken of by the old sailors my father employed, a grain of sand in the center of the Mediterranean, an atom in the infinite.
Precisely, cried Albert.
Well, he of whom I speak is the lord and master of this grain of sand, of this atom. He has purchased the title of Count somewhere in Tuscany.
He is rich, then?
I believe so.
But that ought to be visible.
That is what deceives you, Debray.
I do not understand you.
Have you read the Arabian Nights?
What a question!
Well, do you know if the persons you see there are rich or poor, if their sacks of wheat are not rubies or diamonds? They seem like poor fishermen, and suddenly they open some mysterious cavern filled with the wealth of the Indies.
Afterwards?
My Count of Monte Cristo is one of those fishermen. He has even a name taken from the book, since he calls himself Sinbad the Sailor and has a cave filled with gold.
And you have seen this cavern, Morcerf? Asked Beauchamp.
No, but Franz has. For heaven's sake, not a word of this before him. Franz went in with his eyes blindfolded and was served by mutes and women, to whom Cleopatra was nothing. Only he is not quite sure about the women, for they did not come in until after he had taken some hachis, so that what he took for women might have been simply a row of statues.
The two young men looked at Morcerf as if to say, "Are you mad, or are you laughing at us?"
"And I also," said Morel thoughtfully, "have heard something like this from an old sailor named Penelon."
"Ah," cried Albert, "it is very lucky that Monsieur Morel comes to aid me. You are vexed, are you not, that he thus gives a clue to the labyrinth?"
"My dear Albert," said Debray, "what you tell us is so extraordinary."
"Ah, because your ambassadors and your consuls do not tell you of them. They have no time. They must not molest their countrymen who travel. Now you get angry and attack our poor agents. How will you have them protect you? The chamber cuts down their salaries every day, so that now they have scarcely any. Will you be ambassador, Albert? I will send you to Constantinople.
No, lest on the first demonstration I make in favor of Mehemet Ali, the Sultan send me the bowstring and make my secretary strangle me. There now, said Debray. Yes, but this does not prevent the Count of Monte Cristo from existing.
Pardieu, everyone exists,
doubtless, but not in the same way. Everyone has not black slaves, superb galleys, arms like those at La Casoba, Arabian horses and Greek mistresses. Have you seen his Greek?
I have both seen and heard her. I saw her at the theater and heard her one morning when I breakfasted with the Count.
He eats then?
Yes, but so little it can hardly be called eating.
He must be a vampire.
Laugh if you will. The Countess G, who had known Lord Ruthven, declared the Count was a vampire.
Ah, capital, said Beauchamp. For a man not connected with newspapers, here is the pendant to the famous sea-serpent of the Constitutionnel. Wild eyes, the iris of which contracts or dilates at pleasure, said Debray. Facial angle strongly developed, magnificent forehead, livid complexion, black beard, sharp and white teeth, politeness unexceptionable.
Just so, Lucien, returned Morcerf. You have described him feature for feature.
Yes, keen and cutting politeness. This man has often made me shudder, and one day that we were viewing an execution I thought I should faint more from hearing the cold and calm manner in which he spoke of every description of torture than from the sight of the executioner and the culprit.
At the same time, added Chateau Renaud, your Count of Monte Cristo is a very fine fellow, always accepting his little arrangements with the Italian banditti.
There are no Italian banditti, said Debray. No Count of Monte Cristo. There is 10:30 striking, Albert.
Confess you have dreamed this, and let us sit down to breakfast, continued Beauchamp.
But the sound of the clock had not died away when Germain announced, His Excellency the Count of Monte Cristo. The involuntary start everyone gave proved how much Morcerf's narrative had impressed them, and Albert himself could not prevent himself from feeling a sudden emotion. He had not heard a carriage stop in the street or steps in the antechamber. The door had itself opened noiselessly. The Count appeared, dressed with the greatest simplicity, but the most fastidious dandy could have found nothing to cavil at in his toilette. Every article of dress, hat, coat, gloves, and boots, were from the first makers. He seemed scarcely 35, but what struck everybody was his extreme resemblance with the portrait Debray had drawn. The Count advanced, smiling, into the center of the room, and approached Albert, who hastened towards him, holding out his hand.
Punctuality, said Monte Cristo, is the politeness of kings, according to one of your sovereigns, I think. But it is not the same with travelers. However, I hope you will excuse the 2 or 3 seconds I am behindhand. 500 leagues are not to be accomplished without some trouble, and especially in France, where it seems it is forbidden to beat the postilions.
Monsieur le Comte, replied Albert, I was announcing your visit to some of my friends, whom I had invited in consequence of the promise you did me the honour to make, and whom I now present to you. They are Monsieur le Comte de Chateau Renaud, whose nobility goes back to the 12 peers and whose ancestors had a place at the Round Table. Monsieur Lucien Debray, private secretary to the Ministre de l'Intérieur. Monsieur Beauchamp, an editor of a paper and the terror of the French government, but of whom, in spite of his celebrity, you have not heard of in Italy, since his paper is prohibited there. And Monsieur Maximilien Morel, captain of Spahi. At this name, the Count, who had hitherto saluted everyone with courtesy, but at the same time with coldness and formality, stepped a pace forward, and a slight tinge of red coloured his pale cheeks.
"You wear the uniform of the new French conquerors, monsieur," said he. "It is a handsome uniform."
No one could have said what caused the Count's voice to vibrate so deeply, and what made his eye flash, which was in general so clear, lustrous, and limpid when he pleased.
"You have never seen our Africans, Monsieur le Comte," said Albert.
"Never," replied the Count, who was by this time perfectly master of himself again. "Well, beneath this uniform beats one of the bravest and noblest hearts in the whole army."
"Oh, Monsieur de Morcerf," interrupted Morel. "Let me go on, Captain. And we have just heard," continued Albert, "of a fresh action of Monsieur, and so heroic a one that, although I have seen him today for the first time, I request you to allow me to introduce him as my friend."
At these words it was still possible to remark in Monte Cristo that fixed gaze, that passing colour, and that slight trembling of the eyelid that showed his emotion.
"Ah, you have a noble heart," said the Count. "So much the better."
This exclamation, which corresponded to the Count's own thought, rather than to what Albert was saying, surprised everybody, and especially Morel, who looked at Monte Cristo with surprise. But at the same time the intonation was so soft that, however strange the exclamation might seem, it was impossible to be offended at it.
"Gentlemen," said Albert, "Germain informs me breakfast is ready. My dear Count, allow me to show you the way."
They passed silently into the breakfast room. Everyone took his place.
"Gentlemen," said the Count, seating himself, "permit me to make a confession which must form my excuse for any inconvenance I may commit. I am a stranger, and a stranger to such a degree that this is the first time I have ever been at Paris. The French way of living is utterly unknown to me, and up to the present time I have followed the Eastern customs, which are entirely in contrast to the Parisian. I beg you, therefore, to excuse if you find anything in me too Turkish, too Italian, or too Arabian. Now then, let us breakfast."
"With what an air he says all this," muttered Beauchamp. "Decidedly, he is a great man." "A great man in his country," added Debray.
"A great man in every country, Monsieur Debray," said Chateau Renaud. The Count was, it may be remembered, a most temperate guest. Albert remarked this, expressing his fears lest, at the outset, the Parisian mode of life should displease the traveller in the most essential point. "My dear Count," said he, "I fear one thing, and that is that the fare of the Rue du Eld is not so much to your taste as that of the Place d'Espagne. I ought to have consulted you on the point, and have had some dishes prepared expressly."
"Did you know me better," returned the Count, smiling, "you would not give one thought of such a thing for a traveller like myself, who has successively lived on macaroni at Naples, polenta at Milan, olio podrida at Valencia, pilau at Constantinople, carrick in India, and swallow's nests in China. I eat everywhere, and of everything, only I eat but little. And today that you reproach me with my want of appetite is my day of appetite, for I have not eaten since yesterday morning."
"What?" cried all the guests. "You have not eaten for 24 hours?
"No," replied the Count. "I was forced to go out of my road to obtain some information near Nîmes, so that I was somewhat late, and therefore I did not choose to stop."
"And you ate in your carriage?" asked Morcerf.
"No, I slept, as I generally do when I am weary without having the courage to amuse myself, or when I am hungry without feeling inclined to eat."
"But you can sleep when you please, monsieur?" said Morel.
"Yes. You have a recipe for it, an infallible one."
"May we inquire what is this recipe?" asked Debray.
"Oh, yes," returned Monte Cristo. "I make no secret of it.
It is a mixture of excellent opium, which I fetched myself from Canton, in order to have it pure, and the best hachis, which grows in the east, that is, between the Tigris and Euphrates. These two ingredients are mixed in equal proportions and formed into pills. 10 minutes after one is taken, the effect is produced. Ask Monsieur le Baron France d'Epinay. I think he tasted them one day.
Yes, replied Morcerf. He said something about it to me.
But, said Beauchamp, who in his capacity of journalist was very incredulous, you always carry this drug about you.
Always. Would it be an indiscretion to ask to see those precious pills? Continued Beauchamp, hoping to take him at a disadvantage.
No, monsieur, returned the Count, and he drew from his pocket a marvellous bonbonnier, formed out of a single emerald, enclosed by a golden lid, which unscrewed and gave passage to a small ball of a greenish colour and about the size of a pea. This ball had an acrid and penetrating odour. There were 4 or 5 more in the emerald, which would contain about a dozen. The bonbonnier passed round the table, but it was more to examine the admirable emerald than to see the pills that it passed from hand to hand.
"And is it your cook who prepares these pills?" asked Beauchamp.
"Oh, no, monsieur," replied Monte Cristo. "I do not thus betray my enjoyments to the vulgar. I am a tolerable chemist and prepare my pills myself."
"This is a magnificent emerald and the largest I have ever seen," said Chateau Renaud, "although my mother has some remarkable family jewels."
"I had 3 similar ones," returned Monte Cristo. "I gave one to the Grand Seigneur, who mounted it in his sabre, another to our Holy Father the Pope, who had it set in his tiara, opposite to nearly as large, though not so fine a one, given by the Emperor Napoleon to his predecessor, Pius VII. I kept the 3rd for myself, and I had it hollowed out, which reduced its value, but rendered it more commodious for the purpose I intended it for." Everyone looked at Monte Cristo with astonishment. He spoke with so much simplicity that it was evident he spoke the truth, or that he was mad. However, the sight of the emerald made them naturally incline to the former belief.
"And what did these 2 sovereigns give you in exchange for these magnificent presents?" asked Debray.
"The Grand Seigneur, the liberty of a woman," replied the Count. "The Pope, the life of a man. So that once in my life I have been as powerful as if heaven had made me come into the world on the steps of a throne."
"And it was Peppino you saved, was it not?" cried Morcerf. "It was for him that you obtained pardon."
"Perhaps," returned the Count, smiling.
"Monsieur le Comte, you have no idea what pleasure it gives me to hear you speak thus," said Morcerf. "I had announced you beforehand to my friends as an enchanter of the Arabian Nights, a wizard of the Middle Ages. But the Parisians are people so subtle in paradoxes that they mistake for caprices of the imagination the most incontestable truths, when these truths do not form part of their daily existence. For example, here is Debray who reads and Beauchamp who prints every day. A member of the Jockey Club has been stopped and robbed on the boulevard. That 4 persons have been assassinated in the Rue Saint-Denis or the Faubourg Saint-Germain. That 10, 15, or 20 thieves have been arrested in a café on the boulevard du Temple or in the Thermes de Julien, and who yet contest the existence of the bandits of the Maremna, of the Campagna di Romana, or the Pontine Marshes. Tell them yourself that I was taken by bandits, and that without your generous intercession I should now have been sleeping in the catacombs of Saint Sebastian, instead of receiving them in my humble abode in the Rue du Eld."
"Ah," said Monte Cristo, "you promised me never to mention that circumstance."
"It was not I who made that promise," cried Morcerf. "It must have been someone else, whom you have rescued in the same manner, and whom you have forgotten. Pray speak of it, for I shall not only, I trust, relate the little I do know, but also a great deal I do not know."
"It seems to me," returned the Count, smiling, "that you played a sufficiently important part to know as well as myself what happened. Well, you promise me, if I tell all I know, to relate in your turn all that I do not know."
"That is but fair," replied Monte Cristo. "Well," said Morcerf, "for 3 days I believed myself the object of the attentions of a mask, whom I took for a descendant of Tullia or Poppaea, whilst I was simply the object of the attentions of a contadina, and I say contadina to avoid saying peasant. What I know is that, like a fool, a greater fool than he of whom I spoke just now, I mistook for this peasant girl, a young bandit of 15 or 16 with a beardless chin and slim waist, and who, just as I was about to imprint a chaste salute on his lips, placed a pistol to my head, and, aided by 7 or 8 others, led, or rather dragged me, to the catacombs of Saint Sebastian, where I found a highly educated chief of brigands perusing Caesar's commentaries, and who deigned to leave off reading to inform me that, unless the next morning, before 6 o'clock, 4,000 piastres were paid into his account at his banker's, at 6:15, I should have ceased to exist. The letter is still to be seen, for it is in France d'Epernay's possession, signed by me, and with a postscript of Monsieur Luigi Vampa. This is all I know. But I know not, Monsieur Le Comte, how you contrived to inspire with such respect the bandits of Rome, who have so little respect for anything. I assure you, Franz and I were lost in admiration." "Nothing more simple," returned the Count. "I had known the famous Vampa for more than 10 years. When he was quite a child and only a shepherd, I gave him, for having shown me the way to a place, some pieces of gold. He, in order to repay me, gave me a poniard, the hilt of which he had carved with his own hand, and which you may have seen in my collections of arms. In after years, whether he had forgotten this interchange of presents, which ought to have cemented our friendship, or whether he did not recollect me, he sought to take me, but, on the contrary, it was I who captured him, and 12 of his band. I might have handed him over to Roman justice, which is somewhat expeditious, and which would have been still more so with him, but I did nothing of the sort. I suffered him and his band to depart."
"With the condition that they should sin no more," said Beauchamp, laughing. "I see they kept their promise."
"No, monsieur," returned Monte Cristo, "upon the simple condition that they should respect myself and my friends. Perhaps what I am about to say may seem strange to you, who are socialists, and vaunt humanity and your duty to your neighbor, but I never seek to protect society who does not protect me, and whom, I will even say in general, occupies itself about me only to injure me, and thus giving them a low place in my esteem and preserving a neutrality towards them, it is society and my neighbor who are indebted to me."
"Bravo!" cried Chateau Renaud. "You are the first man I ever met sufficiently courageous to preach egotism. Bravo, Monsieur Le Comte, bravo!"
"It is frank, at least," said Morel. "But I am sure that Monsieur Le Comte does not regret having once deviated from the principles he has so boldly avowed." "How have I deviated from those principles, monsieur?" asked Monte Cristo, who could not help looking at Morel with so much intensity that 2 or 3 times the young man had been unable to sustain the clear and piercing eye of the Count. "Why, it seems to me," replied Morel, "that in delivering Monsieur de Morcerf, whom you did not know, you did good to your neighbor and to society."
"Of which he is the brightest ornament," said Beauchamp, drinking off a glass of champagne.
"Monsieur Le Comte," cried Morcerf, "you are at fault. You, one of the most formidable logicians I know, and you must see it clearly proved that instead of being an egotist, you are a philanthropist. Ah, you call yourself Oriental, a Levantine, Maltese, Indian, Chinese. Your family name is Monte Cristo. Sinbad the Sailor is your baptismal appellation, and yet the first day you set foot in Paris, you instinctively possess the greatest virtue, or rather the chief defect, of us eccentric Parisians. That is, you assume the vices you have not, and conceal the virtues you possess."
"My dear Vicomte," returned Monte Cristo, "I do not see in all I have done anything that merits either from you or these gentlemen the pretended eulogies I have received.
You are no stranger to me, for I knew you since I had given up 2 rooms to you, since I had invited you to breakfast with me, since I had lent you one of my carriages, since we had witnessed the carnival together, and since we had also seen from a window of the Place del Popolo the execution that affected you so much that you nearly fainted. I will appeal to any of these gentlemen. Could I leave my guest in the hands of a hideous bandit, as you term him? Besides, you know, I had the idea that you could introduce me into some of the Paris salons when I came to France. You might, some time ago, have looked upon this resolution as a vague project, but today you see it was a reality, and you must submit to it under penalty of breaking your word. I will keep it, returned Morcerf, but I fear that you will be much disappointed, accustomed as you are to picturesque events and to fantastic horizons. Amongst us, you will not meet with any of those episodes with which your adventurous existence has so familiarized you. There is but one service I can render you, and for that I place myself entirely at your orders, that is, to present or make my friends present you everywhere. Besides, you have no need of anyone to introduce you. With your name and your fortune and your talent, Monte Cristo bowed with a somewhat ironical smile, you can present yourself everywhere and be well received. I can be useful in one way only, if knowledge of Parisian habits, of the means of rendering yourself comfortable, or of the bazaars can assist, you may dispose of me to find you a fitting dwelling here. I do not dare offer to share my apartments with you, as I shared yours at Rome. I, who do not possess egotism, but am yet egotistical par excellence, for, except myself, these rooms would not contain a shadow, unless it were the shadow of a female.
Ah, said the Count, that is a most conjugal reservation. I recollect that at Rome you said something of a projected marriage. May I congratulate you? The affair is still in projection, and he who says in projection means already decided, said Debray.
No, replied Morcerf. My father is most anxious about it, and I hope, ere long, to introduce you, if not to my wife, at least to my intended, Mademoiselle Eugénie Danglars.
Eugénie Danglars, said Monte Cristo. Tell me, is not her father Monsieur le Baron Danglars?
Yes, returned Morcerf, a baron of a new creation.
What matter? Said Monte Cristo, if he has rendered the state services which merit this distinction.
Enormous ones, answered Beauchamp. Although in reality a liberal, he negotiated a loan of 6 millions, £240,000, for Charles X in 1829, who made him a baron and chevalier de la Légion d'honneur, so that he wears the riband not, as you would think, in his waistcoat pocket, but at his buttonhole.
Ah, interrupted Morcerf, laughing. Beauchamp, Beauchamp, keep that for the charivari, but spare my future father-in-law before me. Then turning to Monte Cristo, you just now pronounced his name as if you knew the baron. I do not know him, returned Monte Cristo, but I shall probably soon make his acquaintance, for I have a credit opened with him by the house of Richard and Blunt of London, Arstein and Eschelis of Vienna, and Thompson and French of Rome. As he pronounced the last 2 names, the Count glanced at Maximilian Morel. If the stranger expected to produce an effect on Morel, he was not mistaken. Maximilian started as if he had been electrified.
"Thompson and French," said he. "Do you know this house, monsieur?"
"They are my bankers in the capital of the Christian world," returned the Count quietly. "Can my influence with them be of any service to you? Oh, monsieur le Comte, you could assist me perhaps in researches which have been up to the present fruitless. This house in past years did ours a great service, and has, I know not for what reason, always denied having rendered us this service."
"I shall be at your orders," said Monte Cristo, inclining himself.
"But," continued Morcerf, "apropos of Danglars, we have strangely wandered from the subject. We were speaking of a suitable habitation for the Count of Monte Cristo. Come, gentlemen, let us propose some place. Where shall we lodge this new guest in our great capital?"
"Faubourg Saint-Germain," says Chateau Renaud.
The Count will find there a charming hotel with a court and garden.
Bah, Chateau Renaud, returned Debray, you only know your dull and gloomy Faubourg Saint-Germain. Do not pay any attention to him, Monsieur le Comte. Live in the Chaussée d'Antin. That's the real centre of Paris.
Boulevard de l'Opera, said Beauchamp. On the first floor, a house with a balcony. Monsieur le Comte will have his cushions of silver cloth brought there, and as he smokes his chibouk, see all Paris pass before him.
You have no idea, then, Morel? Asked Chateau Renaud. You do not propose anything? Oh, yes, returned the young man, smiling. On the contrary, I have one. But I expected the Count would be tempted by one of the brilliant proposals made him. Yet, as he has not replied to any of them, I will venture to offer him a suite of apartments in a charming hotel in the Pompadour style that my sister has inhabited for a year in the Rue Mêlée.
You have a sister? Asked the Count.
Yes, monsieur, a most excellent sister.
Married?
Nearly 9 years.
Happy? Asked the Count again.
As happy as it is permitted to a human creature to be, replied Maximilian. She married the man she loved, who remained faithful to us in our fallen fortunes, Emmanuel Urbo.
Monte Cristo smiled imperceptibly. I live there during my leave of absence, continued Maximilian, and I shall be together with my brother-in-law, Emmanuel, at the disposition of Monsieur le Comte, whenever he thinks fit to honour us.
1 minute, cried Albert, without giving Monte Cristo the time to reply.
Take care. You are going to immure a traveller, Sinbad the Sailor, a man who comes to see Paris. You are going to make a patriarch of him.
Oh, no, said Morel. My sister is 25. My brother-in-law is 30. They are gay, young, and happy. Besides, Monsieur le Comte will be in his own house, and only see them when he thinks fit to do so.
Thanks, monsieur, said Monte Cristo. I shall content myself with being presented to your sister and her husband, if you will do me the honour to introduce me. But I cannot accept the offer of any of these gentlemen, since my habitation is already prepared.
What? Cried Morcerf. You are then going to an hotel? That will be very dull for you.
Was I so badly lodged at Rome? Said Monte Cristo, smiling.
Parbleu! At Rome you spent 50,000 piastres in furnishing your apartments, but I presume that you are not disposed to spend a similar sum every day.
It is not that which deterred me, replied Monte Cristo, but as I determined to have a house to myself, I sent on my valet de chambre, and he ought, by this time, to have bought the house and furnished it.
But you have then a valet de chambre who knows Paris, said Beauchamp.
It is the first time he has ever been in Paris. He is black and cannot speak, returned Monte Cristo.
It is Ali, cried Albert, in the midst of the general surprise.
Yes, Ali himself, my Nubian mute, whom you saw, I think, at Rome.
Certainly, said Morcerf. I recollect him perfectly. But how could you charge a Nubian to purchase a house and a mute to furnish it? He will do everything wrong.
Undeceive yourself, monsieur, replied Monte Cristo. I am quite sure that, on the contrary, he will choose everything as I wish. He knows my tastes, my caprices, my wants. He has been here a week with the instinct of a hound, hunting by himself. He will organize everything for me. He knew I should arrive today at 10 o'clock. Since 9 he awaited me at the Barrière de Fontainebleau. He gave me this paper. It contains the number of my new abode. Read it yourself.
And Monte Cristo passed a paper to Albert.
Ah, that is really original, said Beauchamp.
And very princely, added Chateau Renaud.
What? Do you not know your house? Asked Debray.
No, said Monte Cristo. I told you I did not wish to be behind my time. I dressed myself in the carriage and descended at the Vicomte's door.
The young men looked at each other. They did not know if it was a comedy Monte Cristo was playing, but every word he uttered had such an air of simplicity that it was impossible to suppose what he said was false. Besides, why should he tell a falsehood?
"'We must content ourselves, then,' said Beauchamp, "'with rendering Monsieur le Comte all the little services in our power. "'I, in my quality of journalist, open all the theatres to him.'
"'Thanks, Monsieur,' returned Monte Cristo. "'My steward has orders to take a box at each theatre.
"'Is your steward also a Nubian?' asked Debray.
"'No. He is a countryman of yours.' "'if a Corsican is a countryman of anyone's. "'But you know him, Monsieur de Morcerf.
"'Is it that excellent Monsieur Bertuccio "'who understands hiring windows so well?
"'Yes, you saw him the day I had the honour of receiving you. "'He has been a soldier, a smuggler, in fact, everything. "'I would not be quite sure that he has not been mixed up with the police for some trifle, "'a stab with a knife, for instance.'
"'And you have chosen this honest citizen for your steward,' said Debray. "'Of how much does he rob you every year?'
"'On my word,' replied the Count, "'not more than another. "'I am sure he answers my purpose, knows no impossibility, and so I keep him.' "'Then,' continued Chateau Renaud, "'since you have an establishment, a steward, and an hotel in the Champs-Élysées, "'you only want a mistress.'
Albert smiled. He thought of the fair Greek he had seen in the Count's box at the Argentina and Val theatres.
"'I have something better than that,' said Monte Cristo. "'I have a slave. "'You procure your mistresses from the opera, the vaudeville, or the variété. "'I purchased mine at Constantinople. "'It cost me more, but I have nothing to fear.' "'They had long since passed to dessert and cigars.'
"'My dear Albert,' said Debray, rising, "'it is half-past two. "'Your guest is charming, but you leave the best company "'to go into the worst sometimes. "'I must return to the minister's. "'I will tell him of the Count, "'and we shall soon know who he is.'
"'Take care,' returned Albert. "'No one has been able to accomplish that.
"'Oh, we have 3 millions for our police. "'It is true they are almost always spent beforehand. "'But no matter, we shall still have 50,000 francs to spend for this purpose.'
"'And when you know, will you tell me?'
"'I promise you.'
"'Au revoir, Albert.
"'Gentlemen, good morning.'
"'As he left the room, Debray called out loudly,
"'My carriage!'
"'Bravo,' said Beauchamp to Albert. "'I do not go to the chamber, but I have something better to offer my readers than the speech of Monsieur Danglars.
"'For heaven's sake, Beauchamp,' returned Morcerf, "'do not deprive me of the merit of introducing him everywhere. "'Is he not peculiar?'
"'He is more than that,' replied Chateau Renaud. "'He is one of the most extraordinary men I ever saw in my life.
"'Are you coming, Morel?'
"'Directly I have given my card to Monsieur le Comte, "'who has promised to pay us a visit at Rue Mellet, number 14.
"'Be sure I shall not fail to do so,' returned the Count, bowing. "'And Maximilian Morel left the room with the Baron de Chateau Renaud, "'leaving Monte Cristo alone with Morcerf.
42. The Presentation. When Albert found himself alone with Monte Cristo, "'Monsieur le Comte,' said he, "'allow me to commence my ciceroneship "'by showing you a specimen of a bachelor's apartment. "'You, who are accustomed to the palaces of Italy, "'can amuse yourself by calculating in how many square feet "'a young man who is not the worst lodged in Paris can live.' Monte Cristo had already seen the breakfast room and the salon on the ground floor. Albert led him first to his atelier, which was, as we have said, his favourite apartment. Monte Cristo was a worthy appreciator of all that Albert had collected here, old cabinets, Japan porcelain, oriental stuffs, Venetian glass arms from all parts of the world. Everything was familiar to him, and at the first glance he recognised their dates, their country, and their origin. Morcerf had expected he should be the guide. On the contrary, it was he who, under the Count's guidance, followed a course of archaeology, mineralogy, and natural history. They descended to the first floor. Albert led his guest into the salon. The salon was filled with the works of modern artists. There were landscapes of Dupré with their long reeds and tall trees, their lowing oxen and marvellous skies.
Delacroix, Arabian cavaliers with their long white burnous, their shining belts, their damasked arms, their horses, who tore each other with their teeth, whilst their riders contended fiercely with their maces. Aquarelle of Poulenté, representing Notre-Dame de Paris with that figure that makes the artist the rival of the poet. There were paintings by Diaz, who makes his flowers more beautiful than flowers, his suns more brilliant than the sun. Designs of Descamps, as vividly colored as those of Salvator Rosa, but more poetic. Pastel of Giraud and Muller, representing children like angels and women with the features of a virgin. Sketches torn from the Alban of Dorsa's Travels in the East that had been made in a few seconds on the saddle of a camel or beneath the dome of a mosque. In a word, all that modern art can give in exchange and as recompense for the art lost and gone, with ages long since past. Albert expected to have something new this time to show to the traveller, but to his great surprise, the latter, without seeking for the signatures, many of which indeed were only initials, named instantly the author of every picture in such a manner that it was easy to see that each name was not only known to him, but that each of their styles had been appreciated and studied by him. From the salon, they passed into the bedchamber. It was a model of taste and simple elegance. A single portrait signed Leopold Robert shone in its carved and gilded frame. This portrait attracted the Count of Monte Cristo's attention, for he made three rapid steps in the chamber and stopped suddenly before it. It was the portrait of a young woman of 5 or 26, with a dark complexion and light and lustrous eyes veiled beneath their long lashes. She wore the picturesque costume of the Catalan fisherwomen, a red and black bodice and the golden pins in her hair. She was looking at the sea, and her shadow was defined on the blue ocean and sky. The light was so faint in the room that Albert did not perceive the paleness that spread itself over the Count's visage, or the nervous heaving of his chest and shoulders. Silence prevailed for an instant, during which Monte Cristo gazed intently on the picture. "You have there a most charming mistress, Viscount," said the Count in a perfectly calm tone. "And this costume, a ball costume, doubtless, becomes her admirably." "Ah, monsieur," returned Albert, "I would never forgive you this mistake if you had seen another picture beside this. You do not know my mother. She it is whom you see here. She had her portrait painted thus 6 or 8 years ago. This costume is a fancy one, it appears, and the resemblance is so great that I think I still see my mother the same as she was in 1830. The Countess had this portrait painted during the Count's absence. She doubtless intended giving him an agreeable surprise, but, strange to say, this portrait seemed to displease my father, and the value of the picture, which is, as you see, one of the best works of Leopold Robert, could not overcome his dislike to it. It is true, between ourselves, that Monsieur de Morcerf is one of the most assiduous peers at the Luxembourg, a general renowned for theory, but a most mediocre amateur of art. It is different with my mother, who paints exceedingly well, and who, unwilling to part with so valuable a picture, gave it to me to put here, where it would be less likely to displease Monsieur de Morcerf, whose portrait by Gros I will also show you. Excuse my talking of family matters, but as I shall have the honour of introducing you to the Count, I tell you this to prevent you making any allusions to this picture. The picture seems to have a malign influence, for my mother rarely comes here without looking at it, and still more rarely does she look at it without weeping. This disagreement is the only one that has ever taken place between the Count and Countess, who are still as much united, although married more than 20 years, as the first day of their wedding." Monte Cristo glanced rapidly at Albert as if to seek a hidden meaning in his words, but it was evident the young man uttered them in the simplicity of his heart. "Now," said Albert, "that you have seen all my treasures, allow me to offer them to you, unworthy as they are. Consider yourself as in your own house, and to put yourself still more at your ease, pray accompany me to the apartments of Monsieur de Morcerf, to whom I wrote from Rome an account of the services you rendered me, and to whom I announced your promised visit, and I may say that both the Count and Countess anxiously desire to thank you in person." Monte Cristo bowed without making any answer. He accepted the offer without enthusiasm and without regret, as one of those conventions of society which every gentleman looks upon as a duty. Albert summoned his servant and ordered him to acquaint Monsieur and Madame de Morcerf of the arrival of the Count of Monte Cristo. Albert followed him with the Count. When they arrived at the antechamber, above the door was visible a shield which, by its rich ornaments and its harmony with the rest of the furniture, indicated the importance the owner attached to this blazon. Monte Cristo stopped and examined it attentively. "Azure seven merlets, or placed bender," said he. "These are doubtless your family arms. Except the knowledge of blazons that enable me to decipher them, I am very ignorant of heraldry. I, a count of a fresh creation, fabricated in Tuscany by the aid of a commandery of St. Stephen, and who would not have taken the trouble had I not been told that when you travel much it is necessary. Besides, you must have something on the panels of your carriage to escape being searched by the custom-house officers. Excuse my putting such a question to you. It is not indiscreet," returned Morcerf, with the simplicity of conviction. "You have guessed rightly. These are our arms, that is, those of my father. But they are, as you see, joined to another shield, which has gules, a silver tower, which are my mother's. By her side I am Spanish, but the family of Morcerf is French, and, I have heard, one of the oldest of the south of France." "Yes," replied Monte Cristo, "these blazons prove that. Almost all the armed pilgrims that went to the Holy Land took for their arms either a cross in honor of their mission or birds of passage in sign of the long voyage they were about to undertake and which they hoped to accomplish on the wings of faith. One of your ancestors had joined that crusades, and supposing it to be only that of St. Louis, that makes you mount to the 13th century, which is tolerably ancient." "It is possible," said Morcerf. "My father has in his study a genealogical tree which will tell you all that, and on which I made commentaries that would have greatly edified Hozier and Jaucourt. At present I no longer think of it, and yet I must tell you that we are beginning to occupy ourselves greatly with these things under our popular government." Morcerf then opened the door above which were his arms, and which, as we have said, opened into the salon. In the most conspicuous part of the salon was another portrait. It was that of a man from 5 to 8 and 30, in the uniform of a general officer, wearing the double epaulette en torsade that indicates superior rank. The riband of the Legion of Honor round his neck, which showed he was a commander, and on the breast, on the right, the star of a grand officer of the Order of the Saviour, and on the left, that of the Grand Cross of Charles III, which proved that the person represented by the picture had served in the wars of Greece and Spain, or, what was just the same thing as regarded decorations, had fulfilled some diplomatic mission in the two countries. Monte Cristo was engaged in examining this portrait with no less care than he had bestowed upon the other, when another door opened, and he found himself opposite to the Comte de Morcerf himself. He was a man of 40 to 45 years, but he seemed at least 50, and his black moustache and eyebrows contrasted strangely with his almost white hair, which was cut short in the military fashion. He was dressed in plain clothes, and wore at his buttonhole the ribbons of the different orders to which he belonged. This man entered with a tolerably dignified step, and with a species of haste. Monte Cristo saw him advance towards him without making a single step. It seemed as if his feet were rooted to the ground, and his eyes on the Comte de Morcerf. "Father," said the young man, "I have the honour of presenting to you Monsieur le Comte de Monte Cristo, the generous friend whom I had the good fortune to meet in the critical juncture of which I have told you." "You are most welcome, Monsieur," said the Comte de Morcerf, saluting Monte Cristo with a smile, "and Monsieur has rendered our house in preserving its only heir a service which ensures him our eternal gratitude." As he said these words, the Comte de Morcerf pointed to a chair, whilst he seated himself in another opposite the window. Monte Cristo, whilst he took the seat Morcerf offered him, placed himself in such a manner as to remain concealed in the shadow of the large velvet curtains, and read on the careworn and livid features of the Count a whole history of secret grief, written in each wrinkle time had planted there. "Madame la Vicomtesse," said Morcerf, "was at her toilette when she was informed of the visit she was about to receive. She will, however, be in the salon in 10 minutes." "It is a great honour for me," returned Monte Cristo, "to be thus, on the first day of my arrival in Paris, brought in contact with a man whose merit equals his reputation, and to whom fortune has for once been equitable. But has she not still on the plains of Mitidja, or in the mountains of Atlas, a marshal's staff to offer you?"
"Oh," replied Morcerf, reddening slightly, "I have left the service, monsieur. Made a peer at the Restoration, I served through the first campaign under the orders of Marshal Beaumont. I could, therefore, expect a higher rank, and who knows what might have happened had the elder branch remained on the throne. But the revolution of July was, it seems, sufficiently glorious to allow itself to be ungrateful, and it was so for all services that did not date from the imperial period. I tendered my resignation, for when you have gained your epaulettes on the battlefield, you do not know how to maneuver on the slippery ground of the salons. I have hung up my sword and cast myself into politics. I have devoted myself to industry. I study the useful arts. During the 20 years I served, I often wished to do so, but I had not the time. These are the ideas that render your nation superior to any other," returned Monte Cristo. "A gentleman of high birth, possessor of an ample fortune, you have consented to gain your promotion as an obscure soldier, step by step. This is uncommon. Then, become general, peer of France, commander of the Legion of Honor, you consent to again commence a second apprenticeship, without any other hope or any other desire than that of one day becoming useful to your fellow creatures. This indeed is praiseworthy, nay more, it is sublime." Albert looked on and listened with astonishment. He was not used to see Monte Cristo give vent to such bursts of enthusiasm. "Alas," continued the stranger, doubtless to dispel the slight cloud that covered Morcerf's brow, "we do not act thus in Italy. We grow according to our race and our species, and we pursue the same lines, and often the same uselessness, all our lives."
"But, monsieur," said the Comte de Morcerf, "for a man of your merit, Italy is not a country, and France opens her arms to receive you. Respond to her call. France will not, perhaps, be always ungrateful. She treats her children ill, but she always welcomes strangers."
"Ah, father," said Albert with a smile, "it is evident you do not know Monsieur le Comte de Monte Cristo. He despises all honours and contents himself with those that are written on his passport."
"That is the most just remark," replied the stranger, "I ever heard made concerning myself."
"You have been free to choose your career," observed the Comte de Morcerf with a sigh, "and you have chosen the path strewed with flowers."
"Precisely, monsieur," replied Monte Cristo with one of those smiles that a painter could never represent or a physiologist analyze.
"If I did not fear to fatigue you," said the general, evidently charmed with the Count's manners, "I would have taken you to the chamber. There is a debate very curious to those who are strangers to our modern senators. I shall be most grateful, monsieur, if you will at some future time renew your offer. But I have been flattered with the hope of being introduced to the Countess, and I will therefore wait."
"Ah, here is my mother," cried the Viscount. Monte Cristo turned round hastily and saw Madame de Morcerf at the entrance of the salon, at the door opposite to that by which her husband had entered, pale and motionless. When Monte Cristo turned round, she let fall her arm, which for some unknown reason had been resting on the gilded doorpost. She had been there some moments and had overheard the last words of the visitor.
The latter rose and bowed to the Countess, who inclined herself without speaking.
"Ah, good heavens, madame," said the Count. "Are you unwell, or is it the heat of the room that affects you? Are you ill, mother?" cried the Viscount, springing towards her. She thanked them both with a smile.
"No," returned she, "but I feel some emotion on seeing for the first time the man without whose intervention we should have been in tears and desolation. Monsieur," continued the Countess, advancing with the majesty of a queen, "I owe to you the life of my son, and for this I bless you. Now I thank you for the pleasure you give me in thus affording me the opportunity of thanking you, as I have blessed you, from the bottom of my heart." The Count bowed again, but lower than before. He was even paler than Mercedes.
"Madame," said he, "Monsieur le Comte and yourself recompense too generously a simple action. To save a man, to spare a father's feeling or a mother's sensibility, is not to do a good action, but a simple deed of humanity."
At these words, uttered with the most exquisite sweetness and politeness, Madame de Morcerf replied, "It is very fortunate for my son, monsieur, that he found such a friend, and I thank God that things are thus." And Mercedes raised her fine eyes to heaven with so fervent an expression of gratitude that the Count fancied he saw tears in them. Monsieur de Morcerf approached her. "Madame," said he, "I have already made my excuses to Monsieur le Comte for quitting him, and I pray you to do so also. The sitting commences at 2. It is now 3, and I am to speak."
"Go then, and Monsieur and I will strive our best to forget your absence," replied the Countess, with the same tone of deep feeling.
"Monsieur le Comte," continued she, turning to Monte Cristo, "will you do us the honour of passing the rest of the day with us? Believe me, madame, I feel most grateful for your kindness, but I got out of my travelling carriage at your door this morning, and I am ignorant how I am installed in Paris, which I scarcely know. This is but a trifling inquietude, I know, but one that may be appreciated. We shall have this pleasure another time," said the Countess. "You promise that?" Monte Cristo inclined himself without answering, but the gesture might pass for assent.
"I will not detain you, monsieur," continued the Countess. "I would not have our gratitude become indiscreet or importunate."
"My dear Count," said Albert, "I will endeavour to return your politeness at Rome, and place my coupe at your disposal until your own be ready."
"A thousand thanks for your kindness, Viscount," returned the Count of Monte Cristo, "but I suppose that Monsieur Bertuccio has suitably employed the 4 hours and a half I have given him, and that I shall find a carriage of some sort ready at the door." Monte Cristo was not deceived. As soon as he appeared in the Comte de Morcerf's antechamber, a footman, the same who at Rome had brought the Count's card to the two young men and announced his visit, sprang into the vestibule, and when he arrived at the door, the illustrious traveller found his carriage awaiting him.
It was a coupe of Collard's building, and with horses and harness for which Drake had, to the knowledge of all the lions of Paris, refused on the previous day 700 guineas.
"Monsieur," said the Count to Albert, "I do not ask you to accompany me to my house, as I can only show you a habitation fitted up in a hurry, and I have, as you know, a reputation to keep up as regards not being taken by surprise. Give me, therefore, one more day before I invite you. I shall then be certain not to fail in my hospitality. If you ask me for a day, Count, I know what to anticipate. It will not be a house I shall see, but a palace. You have decidedly some genie at your control."
As Monte Cristo sprang into the vehicle, the door was closed, but not so rapidly that he failed to perceive the almost imperceptible movement which stirred the curtains of the apartment in which he had left Madame de Morcerf. When Albert returned to his mother, he found her in the boudoir, reclining in a large velvet armchair. The whole room so obscure that only the shining spangle fastened here and there to the drapery and the angles of the gilded frames of the pictures gave a kind of light to the room.
Albert could not see the countenance of the Countess, which was lost in a thin veil she had put on her head, and which descended around her features like a cloud of vapour, but it seemed to him as though her voice had altered. He could distinguish amidst the perfumes of the roses and heliotropes in the flower stands the sharp and fragrant odour of volatile salts, and he noticed in one of the chased cups on the mantelpiece the Countess's smelling bottle taken from its shagreen case, and exclaimed in a tone of uneasiness as he entered, "My dear mother, have you been unwell during my absence?"
"No, no, Albert. But you know these roses, tuberoses, and orange flowers throw out at first, before one is used to them, such violent perfumes."
"Then, my dear mother," said Albert, putting his hand to the bell, "they must be taken into the antechamber. You are really unwell, and just now were so pale as you came into the room."
"Was I pale, Albert?"
"Yes, a paleness that suits you admirably, mother, but which did not the less